May the words of my mouth and the meditations of our hearts be always acceptable in your sight, O God, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Please be seated. So again, welcome to St. Andrew's on this last day of the church year. It is the last day, and it is known as the Feast of Christ the King, which might sound like it's a very ancient feast going back into the early days of church history, but in fact it's not. It was begun in 1925 by, I think it was Pope Pius IX. I began to look him up a little bit, and with a bit of suspicion, because I think popes during that early 20th century were pretty conservative, pretty resistant to the emergence of new scholarship. But this pope was actually a pretty good guy, and you know, some years later, actually took a pretty strong stand against the Nazis as they began to take over Europe. So, Feast of Christ the King. I hope we hear, even in just that designation, Christ as King, a little bit of an issue, a little bit of ambivalence, perhaps. For the title of King was one that Jesus refused most emphatically during his lifetime. We have to remember that during the lifetime of Jesus, he too lived at a time of great political instability, and the sacred land of Rome was occupied by the defiling infidels of the Roman army. And so people wanted Jesus to be a king in the sense of that we all might ordinarily understand king to be, a political ruler that would throw off the oppressors and restore the sovereign freedom of Israel and their place as God's people. And Jesus, from beginning to end, said, that's not the kind of power I have. And in the interrogation before Pilate, he would say, my kingdom, while a real kingdom, is not of this world. It has a different source of power. It's a different kind of kingship. And so I thought it might be interesting to look at least two incidents in the life of the great sweep of Jewish and Christian history. One going back into the ancient history of Israel, when they first chose for themselves a king. And then secondly, that fateful encounter between the emerging Christian church and the Roman Empire, and the events of the 4th century when the Roman Empire changed its policy of toleration at best and persecution at worst, and actually endorsed this new Christian church and essentially made it the religion of the empire. And in each case, I think there are some aspects of that story that might serve as sort of cautionary for us. Going back to Israel's history, it's before they chose the first king, King Saul. And the government of Israel up until that point had been a sort of loose tribal confederation, essentially an ad hoc form of government that had no standing armies, had no centralized, which is to say, institutional power. It was a confederation of the 12 tribes that more or less trusted that whenever a situation arose that would require leadership, well, a leader would emerge from within their ranks, and they would respond appropriately to the need of the moment. But that obviously is a kind of unstable, insecure. You never know. It's like, well, don't worry about food for the winter. It'll come from somewhere. And people tend not to like that uncertainty with respect to the future. And so they began to say, we want a king. And Samuel, who sort of stands at the earliest line of the prophets, Samuel said, are you sure you want a king? Do you really want a king? And then I printed this out. It's a somewhat long passage from 1 Samuel, but just listen to Samuel's warning. These will be the ways that the king who will reign, these will be the ways of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots, and to be his horsemen, and to run before his chariots. And he will appoint for himself commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and some to plow his ground and to reap his harvest, and to make his implements of war and the equipment of his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive orchards and give them to his courtiers. He will take one-tenth of your grain and of your vineyards and give it to his officers and his courtiers. He will take your male and female slaves and the best of your cattle and donkeys and put them to his work. He will take one-tenth of your flocks, and you shall be his slaves. And in that day you will cry out because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you in that day. So what do you think happened? They go, yeah, Samuel, thank you so much for pointing out this disaster that we're about to walk into. But in fact, that's not what they did. They said, forget it, we want a king anyway. And that began, I mean, that was a huge turning point. They say, we want to be a nation like the other nations. And we want to have a power structure over us. And what Samuel is essentially saying is, don't you understand that when you institutionalize power, that power will serve not you, it will serve itself. And you will become servants to that power. Don't you understand that? That's the way power works in the world. When you institutionalize it, when you focus power here, then that power says, you will serve me. That's the way it worked, and Jesus understood that. You know, he said, power always works in the world. The people who have it will lord it over you, and then they will also say, we want you to understand that it's for your good. They'll want to be called your benefactor. And Jesus said, no, that's not the way, that's not the kind of power I'm about. For the greatest among you must be the one who serves. So that central incident in the life of Israel started a couple of things. First, a long line of kings, among which would be David, who sort of stands as the great king of Israel, but lots of bad kings, lots of corrupt kings, and also the phenomenon of the prophet, who is, in a sense, the ancient check and balance. The prophet and king, that's the system of checks and balances. You need somebody who has the freedom to speak out against the power of the king. And while it often cost the prophets their lives, nonetheless, they were, in a sense, summoned forth to provide a voice to say, is this really the way we should be using power? So that's this incident then, and this wonderful warning against institutions and the ways they insist on being served. Jumping ahead now from probably 1100 BC to the 4th century, early 300s, and as I say, Rome modified under Emperor Constantine, modified this policy of, toleration and or persecution. And Constantine became sort of a Christian and said, Christianity will be the ruler of the, will be the religion of the empire. And it was not too much longer after that that St. Augustine began to write treatises justifying the use of imperial power to serve what he thought were the ends of the church. And the words that ring so ominously come from a parable of Jesus where it was about the invited guests who made excuses. Come to the feast of the kingdom. Now I've got to work my cattle, got some land, got a house, got a business. And the king who had invited them said, oh, that's not good. And they said, go out into the streets and compel them to come in. Augustine heard that. Compel them to come in. And so, soon after, imperial troops were sent out to compel them to come in. Compel them to come into the fold of orthodoxy. Compel them to come in. And if you didn't, if you were a Christian community, that was of a slightly different orientation, a Methodist rather than an Anglican, well, you were outside the imperial protection and subject to imperial prosecution. So we got into bed with the power of Rome. I mean, I've always, you all know that movie, It's a Wonderful Life, when Jimmy Stewart, when Mr. Potter, the bitter old banker, says, well, I can't beat him, I'll get him to join me, and offers Jimmy Stewart a job at about 100 times what he'd been earning. And he says, Mr. Potter, thank you. And he reaches over the desk and shakes hands with Mr. Potter. And the moment he touches that greasy skin, he goes, what am I doing? What am I doing making friends with my arch enemy and thinking that my life will really be served by making friends with Mr. Potter? And he says, whoa, I can't do that. Now, the church did not do that. The church said, Mr. Potter, thank you. And while you're at it, why don't you think about the churches over here, 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 and your armies, because we can use them, because we got some. And subsequent, the fantasy of the Christian West has been to create, and this is sometime in the past now, but the fantasy has been to create a Christian society, almost a theocracy under the guidance of the church, in which all peoples would be united, but under a political structure. This has almost nothing to do with the kind of kingship that Jesus exercised. And the kind of kingship that Jesus exercised is, I think, most profoundly demonstrated in the gospel we hear today. And what is that kind of kingship? My sense of a king or a queen, a sovereign, is that the most important quality of them is that nobody gets to tell them what to do. Nobody, the king is not under anyone else's authority. The king or queen is the authority. And the way Jesus exercised that is, as we hear him on the cross, speaking, praying to God for those who have just crucified him, saying, Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. Now this is Jesus being a king. This is how Jesus understood kingship, to be, in a sense, radically free of the play of the world, where, I mean, there is a very dark, nightmarish version of the golden rule, which says, I'll do to you what you've done to me. That kind of really nightmarish human reciprocity that captures most of the world. I'll do to you what you've done to me, and because you've done it to me, I get to feel justified, I get to feel righteous. Even if what I'm doing to you is a terrible thing, but you've done it first. And Jesus said, that is way upside down. That's not the way things are at all in the reality of God. And so no matter what you do to me, you can even crucify me. I am going to retain my spiritual ability to see what you're doing as an expression of fear and ignorance. And I will pray to God to set you free from that. I will pray to God to set you free from the forces that have captured me. You're killing me out of fear and ignorance, but I see why you're doing it. And I will pray to God that you be set free from those things. I will pray to God for your well-being. Now, this is Jesus being his absolute sovereign best. He is the true king of creation when he can respond to the hatred and violence of the other with his own chosen, perfect compassion and love. And that's the kind of freedom that Jesus invites us into. It's not a sovereignty. It's not a kingship like other kings in the world where, you know, as in, you know, Samuel's warning, you know, we will become oppressed slaves. And it's not a kind of kingship where we use the power of the world to get what we think we need. I mean, Jesus understood perfectly. You can't make people do what's right for them, and you can't really stop people from doing what's wrong. We are unfortunately condemned to live in our freedom, even though we try to get out of it. Well, Jesus didn't want us to get out of it. Jesus wanted us to be free, and deeper and deeper and more deeply free, to be able to love at our own choosing, independent of what the people around us do. Even if people, we are in conflict or we disagree, we retain our inalienable right and freedom to love as we choose, to respond as we choose. And in this, we become not just servants of the King, but as the New Testament speaks of us, kings and queens in our own right, exercising the prerogative of real kings, which is freedom. So I'm going to stop there, and I'm going to say, I haven't said anything at all. I'm going to do kind of a radical jump here. I want to say just a few words about our stewardship season, because I haven't said anything about it so far, and that's not atypical of me. I don't work very well with money, and of the many ways to assess my influence here over these last years, you might say, well, David, you have not provided us the best leadership with money because you're too ambivalent about it and you don't really know how to work with it. So I haven't said much. And I also would say there are kind of several schools for rectors in terms of assessing the financial life of his or her parish. Some rectors know to the penny what every one of you is giving. And I don't know a thing. I have never looked. I don't want to know. I don't want to know what you're giving. I want to look out on you without that kind of information interposing itself at all. But I do want to say the coming years are going to be challenging for St. John's and St. Andrew's. The financial support of St. Mark's is going away, so that there will be a two parish cluster here, and also that in the years when the search committee goes to address that great unknown pool of clergy out in the world, we find that we have to kick the salary up a little bit, that we've fallen a little behind in terms of what congregations elsewhere in the country are paying their clergy. And so I would urge you to really look at what we've got going here at St. Andrew's and value it. I mean, I think we are an important voice in Montana, in Livingston. We're an important voice for each other, where I suspect we have quite a few diverse viewpoints here, and yet we are really practicing a way to be with each other in conversation and extend to each other great compassion and courtesy, even where we differ. And I don't know who can give what. I know some people are able to give really a lot, and it really doesn't even matter very much. And some people who might give $10 a month, that would be sacrificial giving. Whatever it is for you, be as honest as you can with yourself. And know that St. Andrew's is an important community, and that I suspect that we're going to become more important as, again, our culture seems to be heading into kind of divided and difficult times. And if it's important to you to have a voice that is rational and understanding and is really trying to see the largest picture and the good for the most people, please support that. Please support that.